Stellacast, episode 4, Let's Talk a Crispy Skin. Well, hello there, everybody. It's Crispy Skin time on the Stellacast. So hey, check it out. So this is a Crispy Skin forum thread that's been pretty active. And I've just kind of been watching people go back and forth. Now, if you're new to the Stellacast and sort of the audio responses that I do in the forum threads, this might be a little bit in-depth for you. This might be one that you want to skip. Just fair warning, there's a lot of discussion going on here, and it's going to be all about crispy skin, which who doesn't love crispy skin? Crazy people, that's who. So we're going to talk crispy skin. We're starting off with a man-bear-pig, half-man, half-bear, half-pig. You do the math. And Man Bear Pig in his Crispy Skin thread says, I've been cooking since I came on here. I consider here, I guess, the Stella Culinary Forum. So Man Bear Pig, does that mean that you didn't even cook until you came onto the Stella Culinary Forum? Well, that's pretty nuts. Nah, that can't be true. Anyway, it's just curious. My biggest problem, he says, have been with my proteins. I have followed a lot of the roast chicken recipes online. One thing I never got was crisp skin. I do pan-fried breast and can get a crisp skin on that, but that's it. For me, crispy skin is so important. I've listened to all audios which might relate to the subject and hear you guys speak of blanching. Blanching is adding water to the skin, so why does it work? What is the reasoning behind blanching? I haven't tried blanching, so have nothing to add. I do find air drying has given me a much better result than anything else, although it's time-consuming. I once read that Boston Market doesn't brine their chickens at all. They air dry them for 24 hours, and this gives them the same effect as brining. Anybody believe that, or is it just more BS? Can't see how air drying would be the same as brining, given the same effect. Okay, so a couple of things. Let's answer your last question first. I would assume that Boston Market, what they're doing and what other people are doing when they're air drying like that, is they're salting as well. So you would heavily salt the chicken. Usually about 1% salt by the total weight of the chicken is a good starting point. And you're covering the chicken all around with the salt and then allowing it to air dry for 24 hours in your refrigerator. And what this does, so what happens is the salt will first draw a little bit of moisture, surface moisture, out of the chicken. And this just is caused by simple osmosis. So the salt is drawing the moisture up to the surface of the chicken. That moisture is then dissolving the salt, and that salt, given enough time, will diffuse inward into the chicken, and this will affect the protein structure just like traditional brining will. And we talk a lot about brining in our three-part video series in our food science section on stellaculinary.com. And as that salt penetrates the meat of the chicken, it partially denatures the protein filaments, which allow it to hold on to moisture during the cooking process, which allows it to remain more juicy. Now, the benefit to this, or the pro to doing this dry salting, is it doesn't introduce a lot of moisture to the surface of the chicken, and moisture is what's going to cause the chicken to not crisp properly. So to get crispy skin, you have to first drive moisture out of the skin, right? I mean, so if you want anything to crisp, I mean, crisping is dehydration. So you can't have something that's crisp if it contains a lot of moisture. So when you dry salt something, you are allowing that salt, given enough time. So you can't just dry salt your chicken skin or your chicken, which I assume the skin is on. So you can't just dry salt like a whole roasted chicken, leave it for an hour, and then roast it and expect to have awesome results. So what you're doing is when you're dry salting and letting it sit overnight in the refrigerator for at least 24 hours, that salt is able to diffuse inward into the chicken. It changes the protein structure, allows it to hold on to more moisture during the cooking process, a lot like brining does without the added moisture. So the chicken's not going to be really juicy like a brine chicken, but sometimes people prefer that because there's still going to be more moisture retention just based upon the fact that the salt is allowing the proteins to hold on to moisture more readily when heat is applied during the cooking process. And the skin is also allowed to dry out, which allows it to crisp. Now, the blanching step is used to break down the collagen in the skin, and this is more important with items that or skin that contains more collagen than chicken. So chicken skin does contain a decent amount of collagen, but it's not nearly as sturdy as duck skin or goose skin or pig skin, right? So to get a duck skin to really crisp or pig skin to really crisp during the cooking process, you first need to blanch it. So when I do a whole roasted pig, what I will do is lay the pig out on a on a large tray that has some good drainage. And when I do a pig, I'm usually doing like a 50, 60 pound pig. So not like a massive, like 300 pounder, but this will still work. It's just going to be, it's hard to find an oven that large to cook a 300 pound pig in. So I'll take, my 50, 60 pound pig, and that will, I can normally get it to fit on a sheet rack if I lay it corner to corner, with, elevated by a wire rack, and I'll, pour boiling water all over the skin, and I'll repeat this process 3 to 4 times. And what that boiling water does is it is hot enough to dissolve the collagen in that skin. And pig skin contains a ton of collagen. I believe it's about 30 to 40%. I think 30% collagen. And if you don't dissolve that collagen first, that skin will never crisp because that collagen is going to hold on to a lot of moisture and a lot of fat. And so the first step that you want to do to crisp skin is to dissolve collagen. Then the next step is to drive out fat and water. And when you drive out the fat and you drive out the water during cooking, the skin will crisp. But that's never going to happen until you break the collagen down, which is where blanching comes in. So in the case of a whole roasted pig, I'll just pour boiling water all over the skin a few times, and then I'll roast the pig in the oven, and the skin will come out beautiful and crisp. Now with duck, a lot of time, what we've been doing in recently is when we're trying to get like a crispy skin duck breast, is we will take the whole duck and hold it by its legs. So we're holding it upside down. And we are dipping the breast portion of the duck, which is basically the top half of the duck, we are dipping it into boiling water for about 45 to 60 seconds, then pulling it out and placing it directly in an ice bath, and we repeat that for 3 or 4 times total. And what that's doing is it's you're exposing the skin to boiling water and then chilling it before it has time to penetrate the breast and to cook it. So the 3 times in the boiling water, 3 times in the salt, 3 times in the ice alternating is going to break down the collagen in that duck skin. Then we will actually take the breast off of the duck, and we have a video on how to butcher whole ducks in our knife skills area of stellaculinary.com. So if you go to stellaculinary.com/CKS, which stands for Culinary Knife Skills, that's the short code that will drop you into our knife skills video series, and you can see how we break down a duck. So after the blanching process, we remove the duck breast from the duck, and then we will cook sous vide about 56 degrees Celsius for 2.5 hours. And so what we're doing first is we are breaking down the collagen in the skin. Then we are cooking the duck breast sous vide, which allows us to get an even cooked piece of meat all the way through. And then on the pickup, when after the duck breast has been sous vide, and a lot of the times we will, we do all of this before dinner service, and then we get an order for a duck breast. We will drop it in the hot water bath for about 15 to 20 minutes to retherm. Then we will take the breast we'll cut it out of the package, and then place it into a hot cast iron pan with a little bit of oil. And we're not going too hot because we still want to allow some time for a little bit of excess fat to render out of the duck skin because it still doesn't render completely. So we're talking like medium high heat, skin side down in the cast iron pan, and really just trying to drive out that last little bit of fat to crisp the skin. And that works pretty good for us. So as you can see there, man, bear, pig, you can use blanching to create a crispy skin. Now, one of the approaches that we use for our chicken wings that we actually like a lot is we will steam the wings. And so what we're doing when we steam the wings is we're technically blanching them. But steam is a lot more controllable than boiling water. And it's a bit of a more gentle cooking medium. So boiling water is very, very harsh. Now, here's something interesting with boiling water versus steam. So it takes about 5 times more energy. So you have, so temperature is basically just a way that you measure molecular movement. So the faster molecules are moving, the hotter they are, right? And that can also be referred to as heat energy. So it takes a certain amount of heat energy to raise water to its boiling point, right? It takes 5 times that amount of heat energy to take that boiling water and then transition it into steam. So what a lot of people think, so water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level, 100 degrees Celsius at sea level. So what people think, because steam is the next step up in boiling water, that steam is actually hotter than boiling water. And technically, when applied to a cooking technique, it's not. And so it will actually stay at boiling temperature, but it doesn't affect your food as much as boiling water because of something called the film condensate. So what will happen is, so when you're steaming something, also too, when you steam anything, you actually want to steam below the fog line. So visually what you see as steam rising from your pot of boiling water isn't steam. It is water vapor that is recondensing in the air, which is why you can see it. So as that water vapor recondenses in the air, it refracts light. And as that light is refracted, you can then see this gray steam or this smoke that we see as fog. But when you look at a pot of boiling water, you will notice that this fog line is above the water line, right? So you have this gap. So you have boiling water, you have a gap where you don't see any fog, and then you have the fog line above that gap. Well, it's in that gap that true steam actually exists. So when you have something sitting in the fog line of boiling water, it's sitting in technically recondensed water, which isn't steam and has a much lower heat energy and a lower temperature than steam does. So when you're steaming something, you want to make sure that you're steaming your product below the fog line. So just above the boiling water, but below the fog line. And that's where you're getting the real steam. Now, when that steam hits your chicken wings, your vegetables, or whatever it is that you are steaming, it condenses on the wings itself and forms a really thin film of water mixed with air. And this is called the film condensate because you have water condensing on the surface of the product that you're steaming. Now, this acts as a buffer to the hot heat of the steam. And it acts as a diffusion layer. And because you have this diffusion layer in place, this very thin film of condensed water and air on the surface of the product that you're steaming, this diffusion layer allows for much more even and precise heating. So steaming is a lot more precise and a gentler approach than boiling. So yes, you could parboil wings in water to par cook them and to break down some of the collagen and render some of the fat in those chicken wings, so then you could, later go and fry them crispy. But it is a lot harder to control because boiling water is a blunt force tool for cooking items. So you have that direct contact with the boiling water with your wing, and the interior flesh of the wing will overcook pretty quickly. Versus steaming, you can steam the wings to break down the collagen in the skin and render out some of the fat, and also par cook the wings. We've had really good success with steaming our wings for 10 minutes, and this is just long enough to break down a lot of the collagen and render some of the fat in the skin of the chicken wings, and then par cook the wings almost all the way through. We then take the wings, place them on a wire rack to drain, and go straight into our walk-in. We chill overnight, and chilling overnight is going to allow the skin to fully dry out. So that drying step is important, whether you want crispy skin on your chicken wings or crispy skin for your whole roast of chicken. So you can actually blanch your chicken skin, and I'll do this sometimes at home when I'm spatchcocking my chicken. So if you search spatchcocking, or you know, I'll put a link in the show notes to this episode of spatchcocking the chicken. Oh, and by the way, so all of our show notes for StellaCast can be found using a short code. So you would go to stellaculinary.com/StellaCast4. So it's /StellaCast and the episode. So the episode that we're recording right now is episode 4. So if you want to go back and find show notes or contribute to the show, or contribute to the show notes, just go to StellaCast or StellaCorner.com/StellaCast and the episode number, and it'll drop you right into the show notes. So I'll put a link to the spatchcock chicken video that I do. But basically, with the spatchcock chicken, you're cutting out the backbone of the chicken and you're butterflying it flat, which gives you a much more even roasting and the skin crisps better using that approach. So what I'll do is I'll spatchcock the chicken, lay it flat so it's skin side up, and I'll pour some boiling water over the skin right before I roast it. And you pop it in the oven and you actually get a better, much more crispy skin that way as well. Now you can be saying, well, you know, you're adding moisture to the skin. How does that work? Well, because the hot heat from your dry oven is going to drive the moisture out of the skin anyways. But what really holds that moisture in the skin is the collagen that that helps to bind to the water in the skin. So just try this out at home. Take your chicken, use the spatchcocking method, and then pour some water over the top, some hot boiling water over the top. I just use a ladle, and then pop it in your oven and roast. Now, if you have the time, after you pour that boiling hot water all over that skin, heavily sprinkle the skin with salt and then let it hang out in your refrigerator for 24 hours and then roast your chicken. And you're going to get a really amazingly crispy skin with a moist interior. All right, so that is the crisp skin. Let's see what everybody else is saying about this process. Barbecue player says air drying is not time consuming if you freeze. Air dry, then cut into 8 pieces and freeze. I freeze wings and there's no difference. Can't see a whole chicken cut up would not be the same. So the problem with doing that is after you air dry and you freeze, then when you thaw, you can have moisture migrate back into the skin during the thawing process. Now, it works good with wings because you're first air drying the wings, then you're, I assume, par cooking. That's how I would do it. You'd par cook the wings, and then you freeze it, and you're working the wings directly out of the freezer a lot of the times, which is going to drive moisture. Any moisture that migrates to the surface is going to evaporate when it hits the hot oil. But really, if you want crispy chicken skin, the way to go, if you have a time constraint, the way to go is to spatchcock it. So you remove the backbone, you butterfly it out, pour boiling water over the skin, and then give it a good sprinkling of salt, and then roast it in a really hot oven. The hotter, the better. So you're looking to quick roast your chicken. You're not looking to slow roast it, because you really want to drive that moisture out of the skin. Now, if you have extra time, you can actually slow roast the chicken. And what I would do then is you want to roast it at 225 degrees Fahrenheit in your oven. and bring it up to about 150 degrees Fahrenheit. And sometimes I'll even go lower. Sometimes I go 140 degrees Fahrenheit for the whole roast of chicken. And then I play around with switching my oven off and on, right? So when it starts flirting with going above 140 degrees internal temperature, I'll turn my oven off. And I'm monitoring the internal temperature of the chicken using a probe thermometer that is stuck in its leg and thigh. And I use what's called a Chef Alarm by ThermoWorks. And it's a really good probe thermometer that has a lead cord attachment that attaches to an external thermometer. So you have the probe in your oven inside the chicken with a cord attaching it to your thermometer readout that is on the outside of your oven. And you can set it to beep at you when your chicken reaches a certain internal temperature, when any meat really reaches a certain internal temperature. And then I'll try and hold it at around 140 to 145 degrees internal temperature for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. So this takes some time. It takes some fussing. But this is just another option if you want to get a little more in depth. And this will give you an evenly cooked piece of chicken that's safe to eat at a lower temperature. So you're below the temperature at which muscle fibers start to fully constrict and dry out, which is 150 to 155 degrees Fahrenheit. So now at that point, after my chicken has been there at 140 degrees Fahrenheit for about an hour and a half, I will pull it out of my oven and let it rest for at least 30 to 45 minutes. Really, I'm letting it drop to an internal temperature of about 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And while it's dropping in temperature, I'm cranking my oven up to 475, 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Then, once my oven is at that high temperature, and the internal of my internal temperature of my chicken has dropped to about 110 degrees Fahrenheit, I then pop that chicken back into the oven, and I'm just trying to hit it with as much heat as possible so the skin will fully crisp. Because again, so that gentle heating is allowing us to cook our chicken more evenly, and it's cooked all the way through, and we're holding it at at 140 degrees Fahrenheit to pasteurize it. So again, as we talked about in a previous episode, if you cook a chicken to 165 degrees Fahrenheit and hold it there for 15 seconds, it's safe to eat, but you're at a temperature higher than the temperature at which muscle fibers fully dry out. So what we're doing is we're cooking our chicken to a lower internal temperature and then holding it there for an extended period of time, an hour and a half, to pasteurize it and make it safe to eat. Then we're allowing that internal temperature to drop, so that way it doesn't overcook when we then place it in a rockin' hot oven to crisp the skin. So at that point, you just take your spatchcock chicken that's already been slow roasted, your oven is nice and hot, the internal temperature has dropped, and you pop it back in your oven just long enough for the skin to blister and get nice and crackly and crisp. So that's another approach. Again, it takes more time. It's a little bit more fussy. So it's all about how much time you really want to spend on roasting your chicken. And the more time you spend, whether it's letting your chicken dry out overnight or for 24 hours after salting it, letting it slow roast, you know, so you're just going to get a better end product. So a pretty good way to roast a chicken is just spatchcocking it, pouring boiling water over it, and then giving it some salt, some pepper, and popping in your oven. Boom. Good to go. It's going to be just light years ahead of most just dry, shitty roasted chicken that people cook and serve. But then you add the salting step where after you've blanched the skin by pouring boiling water over it, you then salt it and let it sit for 24 hours in your refrigerator. That's going to make it even more better, right? Then you take it and instead of just roasting it from start to finish in a hot oven, you then do the two-step cooking process where you slow roast it in a low oven, let it rest, then roast it in a really hot oven. That's going to make the chicken even better, right? So you're adding these extra steps depending upon, you know, how much time you have and how awesome you want that chicken to really be. But, I mean, most people really don't fully grasp the concept of roasting a whole chicken anyways. So just spatchcocking it and pouring boiling water over it and then salting it and then popping it into like a 475 degree oven until that chicken skin is nice and golden brown, you know, about 45 minutes to an hour, it's going to be much better chicken than most people ever cook or eat. And again, check out our spatchcock cooking video that I do with the chicken, because what's cool about that is I actually roast the chicken over some vegetables. And the juices drip down into the vegetables, and then we form a glaze on those vegetables as that chicken rests. So that's a really nice approach. Zalbar, who is a longtime member of the Stella Culinary community, and actually he goes all the way back to the Free Culinary School days. So Zalbar is a real legit OG, original gastronome, as I say. I know it's a cheesy joke. So Zalbar says high temp and lots of salt, preheat oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and then lower it to 350, 375 when putting the chicken in. Also, make sure to raise the chicken above the baking sheet with a grill, or put them above fun stuff like diced potatoes, carrots, and onions, and a casserole dish. You need at least 40 minutes for all the fat to render if the chicken in pieces, or at least an hour if the chicken is whole roasted. Yeah, so good advice there from Zalbar, and he's using the approach that I use when he's talking about putting vegetables underneath it. So in our spatchcock chicken video, you'll see that I put I'm using a large saute pan or a large skillet with vegetables in that pan with the chicken butterflied out across the top. I prefer a higher temperature for roasting chicken than Zalbar does, but different strokes for different folks. It's really all about figuring out what works best in your oven. But for me, I don't do a whole lot of middle temp cooking in my oven, unless I'm baking something, like if I'm baking brioche bread. But when it comes to meats, either I'm going like really, really hot, or I'm doing a two-step cooking method where I go really low and slow, and then I finish with high, hot heat. So in the sense of chicken, if I'm not going to slow roast it at like 225 or 250 degrees Fahrenheit for a number of hours, and I'm kind of more in a rush, then I'm just going to just blast it in a 475 degree oven, because that quick hot heat allows that skin to crisp really fast, and then you pull it out and you're allowing it to rest. Now, the risk that you run with that is you can go from the chicken being perfectly cooked to way overcooked and dry pretty quickly. Whereas if you're cooking at a lower temperature, like Zalbar recommends, the process is a little bit more forgiving. However, I don't think that the skin usually doesn't come out as crisp at that temperature, at least in my personal experience. And it takes a little bit longer. It's just it's different approaches for different people. For me personally, though, I either like really low and slow or hot and fast. And you'll see that theme pop up in my approach to cooking a lot of things when you watch our videos or listen to our podcasts. But again, I'm just one dude with a microphone. So the golden rule of Stella Culinary is to educate yourself as much as possible, learn as many different approaches as possible, try and understand the science and the methodology behind those approaches, and then figure out what works best for you. Noya Greenberg, is crisping skin not to do with breaking down collagen? Absolutely. So Noya, you hit the nail right on the head. I'm going to have some Stella stars come your way, because we have touched on this in the past. So yeah, crisping skin has everything to do with collagen breakdown. Now Barbecue Player is asking about freezing and how it has an effect on the crispness of skin, specifically for chicken wings. And this can be done. What's the guy's name from Mission Street Chinese? It's Danny Boeing, I think is how you pronounce his last name. Well, let me do a quick little search for Mission Street. And it's Bowien, like, so it's Bowen or Boeing. His cookbook is really good. It's very inspiring. I own it. It's called Mission Street Chinese. I would highly recommend, if you're into that sort of food, that you give his book a look-see. But he talks about how he will first par cook his chicken wings and then freeze them overnight. And the purpose of that, so also what's nice about that approach is you have par cooked chicken wings on demand. So normally with chicken wings, you do a two-step cooking process where you first par cook them, and that helps to break down the collagen in the skin, drive out some moisture from the skin, which allows it to crisp up better on the second cooking. So the Mission Street Chinese approach is to par cook just by par frying, which is fairly traditional, lay out on sheet trays, and then allow it to cool in the walk-in overnight. And then, well, I believe they let it cool first, and then you pop it into your freezer. And then as that skin freezes, it will drive more moisture in the form of ice crystals out of the skin. So it's a pretty good theoretical approach. In our testing, we have found that the freezing approach makes the wings a little more convenient to execute, but not necessarily giving them a superior crispy skin or a superior internal texture. We have found that what really plays a big role in the crisping of the skin and the interior texture of the chicken wings is the method that you apply in the first cook or in the par cook. And we just actually finished a lot of our testing. And look, there's so much that you could always test. So again, we do testing on our ends. We come up with our favorite method and approach to various recipes, and then we try and publish those results and give you, what worked best for us. But really, the last thing I ever want to happen is for you to take what I say as gospel, as if, like, this is how it's done. There's no other way to do it. This is the end of the line. And that goes against the complete grain of what I stand for and what Stella Culinary stands for, in the culinary education vein. You can always make something better. Nothing in the food world is ever perfect. You can always march forward and make it better. But at some point, you got to stop your testing and say, okay, yes, we could work on the perfect chicken wing for the next 10 years, but at some point, we got to serve these wings and we got to publish our results online, right? So you got to come to a stopping point that you're comfortable with, and then you always just make it sort of an ongoing project. So definitely test freezing on your end, but if you're not par cooking the wings properly, then freezing isn't going to make up for that. Freezing could enhance it. That hasn't been my results with the limited testing that we have done on freezing. It doesn't make it worse, but it doesn't make it considerably better when done in double-blind taste tests. And again, that's just my results. Test everything on your end. Selena says, you will get crisp skin using sous vide, but you won't get the bubbling effect. From the article that Kenji published, she's talking about Serious Eats. I think Kenji must be referring to the middle part, because this recipe for the meaty part of wings comes out dry. I bought a sous vide supreme, and Jacob's wings are moist and crisp. However, they do not have the bubbled paper-thin surface of Kenji's wings. Then again, a lot of folks might not desire the bubble effect. It's more of a Korean thing. So, Selena, the best way that I have found to get that bubble effect is through steaming. Either way, they're so dry, so who cares how crisp they are? We have found that by trying to replicate other people's recipes through our testing, that there's a lot of really shitty chicken wing recipes out there. And I'm not sure why. And so there's only one way to describe this. And please don't get offended, because I'm going to have to use a stronger word than shit. And that is the big old F-bomb. But people get mind-fucked by recipes online. Okay? Earmuffs, I know. I'm sorry. And what I mean by that is, there are some people, and I hope this never happens to me, there are some people whose voices carry so much weight, for whatever reason, that other people will get tricked into thinking that their recipes are good, when really they're shit. So they're getting mind-fucked into thinking that this recipe is good, when it's not. And that has been my vast experience with chicken wings and with pizza specifically. You see it a lot with all different various recipes across the internet, but specifically you see it all the time with chicken wings and with pizza. People proclaim that this dough is awesome and it works great and the dough is complete shit. People will say the same thing about various approaches to chicken wings, and the chicken wings are just awful and dry. Specifically, any wing recipe that tells you that you can get crispy chicken wings in your oven is not to be trusted. You have a recipe by a well-known gentleman on the Food Network who is highly respected in many, many circles, who will first steam the wings and then recommends that you bake them at a high temperature for 20 minutes on each side. And yeah, the wings do get crispy, but they are drier than shit, whether you brine them or not. And I prefer not to brine my chicken wings. Even though I'm a big brining fanatic, I find that brined chicken wings just aren't what I'm after, personally. And I've decided that after taste testing. You also have another website out there that does amazing work with really, really good videos and has a lot of very strong content. And their approach is to pressure cook the chicken wings for 15 minutes, which is nuts. It's absolutely nuts. I mean, you can pressure cook, chicken legs for 10 minutes and risk overcooking them. And they pressure cook their chicken wings for 15 minutes and then fry them. And you see all these people who just repeat over and over and over, oh, you got to try so-and-so's, pressure cooked chicken wings. They're the best. And no, they're not. They're shit. They're dry. And the skin doesn't even crisp all that well. So, yeah, there's a lot of bad recipes out there. And people just get, for whatever reason, they almost get intimidated into thinking that the recipe is good because, so-and-so has such a big name and is so well-respected that if he says it's good, then it must be good. And then you see all of so-and-so's sycophants in the comment section saying, oh, this was the best recipe ever, yada, yada, yada. So everyone just sees it, well, so-and-so says it's good and all of his followers says that it's good, so it must be good. So this must be what a good chicken wing tastes like, when really, no, it tastes like shit. The wing is kind of crispy, and the interior is just dry and mealy. Both the approaches of the steam and then bake, and then the pressure cooked and then fried were both so dry that me and Ben and Alex, when we were testing these recipes, we were spitting out the wings and we were throwing the rest away. And look, you guys have seen me in my videos. I'm a big fat dude, right? I love chicken wings. A chicken wing has to be pretty bad for me to spit it out of my mouth. So, yeah, there's a lot of shitty wing recipes out there, unfortunately. And we've done a lot of tests, and we have some good ones that we are going to publish very soon. In descending order of greatness, our number one favorite is the sous vide and then fry chicken wings. My second favorite, and tying pretty close, but just in a different category totally, is where we did velveted chicken wings. But they're completely different than the other chicken wings that we did. So those are kind of in a category of their own, but they come out pretty damn awesome. So for traditional chicken wings, our favorite was the sous vide and then fried. And then every time we par cook wings, we always let them rest overnight on a wire rack in our refrigerator so the skin has a chance to dry out for crisping. So number one, sous vide and then fry. Number two is steam and then fry. Number three is fry and then fry. Number four is confit and then fry. Steam and bake, pressure cook and bake are total shit. And then also, too, just the traditional method of just frying from start to finish. So you take the raw, fresh wings. You don't par cook them. You just fry them from start to finish. Usually takes about 8 to 12 minutes in your fryer. That's supposedly the traditional buffalo approach. Tradition is tradition. But there's also a reason why I say nothing is ever perfect and we should always expand through testing, because the single fry approach to wings just isn't that good. As for freezing, improving crisp skin, says Selena, the following comment is in the articles below. They have some good suggestions for creating fried chicken that call for repeated freezing to break down the cell walls in the skin. So freezing must do something. Maybe. I haven't read anything convincing on it. A lot of it is all... A lot of it is all anecdotal. Now here, so just briefly looking at the post that you linked, Selena, they're dusting their chicken wings in cornstarch, to which I say, cheater, cheater, pumpkin eater. Because it's just different, right? So yeah, if you dust something in a starch, you're going to get it to crisp. That's the whole purpose of breading fried chicken. And it's not a bad approach. It's just a different approach. You're cheating. So what we're talking about when we're doing our chicken wing testing is the naked wing approach, where you are part of cooking it and then frying the skin until it crisps. If you are dusting it in starch, then yes, you can get a crispy coating via the starch, just like you would in fried chicken. But you are, in essence, cheating. Now, the whole saying of cheaters never prosper is bullshit. Because, I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's all about serving a good, tasty chicken wing or a piece of fried chicken that people are willing to pay you money for to eat. Or that when your friends come over to your house and they eat it, they go, oh my God, that's awesome. I love it. So, and that's why I separate the velveted chicken wings out into another category and say, well, we loved those. They were good. But we can't compare them to anything else because all of our other tests were trying to hit the mark on the perfect naked fried chicken wings. There was no starch coating. In the velveting approach, what is part of velveting is coating in starch. So we use cornstarch in that approach. And I did shoot video on it, so I will be posting that with our other chicken wing content. But you can't compare them to the naked wing approach because it's completely different. So in the linked article, I didn't have time to read through it because I'm reading through your thread or the crispy skin thread. I'm approaching this cold, and I just don't want to read somebody else's article live on mic because you're going to be hearing me do a lot of ba-ba-ba-ba and da-da-da-da. But, you know, the first thing that jumped out at me is they are coating their chicken wings in cornstarch, which is cheating. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but you're still a cheater. Jay Weinstein, what's up, Jay? Jay says, hey, Jacob has just blown my mind on the sauce thread. Hey, if you haven't checked out our sauces thread yet, I would do so. It's pretty in-depth. But you can't link crisp skin to a sauce. I'm getting pretty good wings in my pressure fryer. Only problem is they have to be done in a straight single fry. Problem with that is they take about 9 minutes. I hope to be a fast food place, so can't be waiting that long. So I've been researching holding cabinets, and they cost about $3,000. So I'd want to know what I'm doing before I spend my money on that. To be continued on the next post. So in his next post, Jay Weinstein says, the only problem I see with a holding cabinet is the skin. I just can't see the skin staying crisp. Is that just me, or could a holding cabinet keep that skin crisp? Jacob was helping out other people on sauces who wanted a charred taste, so you know where this is going. So let's say I pressure fry and get a crisp skin and juicy interior. I then place the wing in a holding cabinet set up below 65 degrees Celsius. That will maintain a moist interior, but it will probably also do so at the expense of the skin. Would any of the finishing methods you discuss save the skin and crisp it up? Is that possible? So a couple of options that you have open to you. So first of all, Winston Industries has a holding cabinet called the CVAP, and that's made specifically to hold things crisp. So I would talk to Winston. I would look into their technology. However, part of the way that they maintain temperature is through humidity control. So you will have some form of humidity in there. That doesn't mean that you can't hold something crisp. However, most of the things that are held crisp, to my knowledge, have some sort of breading or coating on it. So that's one thing. Now, another thing that you could look at doing is with the same holding cabinet, what I might do is, well, I mean, look, we've had really good results with 3.5 minute fries after par cooking. So even though it's not high tech, Jay, something that I would test on your end is try steaming your wings for 10 minutes. And then after you've steamed them, let them hang out in your refrigerator overnight and then fry at full blast in just an open fryer. So you're not frying under pressure. Fry at about 309 degrees Fahrenheit for 3.5 minutes. And we do this with jumbo wings. And with jumbo wings, it works out really, really well. It's my second favorite method right next to doing it sous vide. Now, as we talked about in previous podcasts, we were having issues with the myoglobin. So you don't like, Jay, from our past conversations, I know that you don't like that sort of red color on the bone, because people will bite into a chicken wing, they see a sort of reddish colored bone, they think it's undercooked. Now, as touched upon previously, the reason why that happens is when you do a slow heat, it sets the red color in the myoglobin. So doing a slow heat, something like a sous vide, right? You're slow cooking at a lower temperature, you're setting the red color in that myoglobin. So either you're cooking the chicken all the way through, you're still going to have issues with that pink or redness color that freaks people out with chicken, right? So even though sous vide is our favorite method for par cooking wings before we let them rest overnight in the fridge and then fry them, you're not going to ever get away from that red myoglobin issue. Now, the next favorite for me personally is the steam-fried wings, where we first steam them for 10 minutes, let them sit overnight, and then fry them the next day. Now, with steaming, you don't have the red bone issues, because steaming is you're cooking at a higher temperature and you're cooking faster. You're cooking for 10 minutes versus the 4 hours that we sous vide the wings for. So that would be a good approach for you that I think that you should test, because then when you fry them on the pickup, you only need to fry them for 3.5 minutes, which works out very well for a fast food application. Now, when you're doing high volume in fast food, you're still going to probably want to look at holding cabinets. So talk to the people over at Winston. No, they're not a sponsor of this podcast, although they probably should be since I recommended them quite a few times. I think when you're doing like fast food or like a fast service, you're always going to have trade-offs. You're going to have trade-offs on anything, right? So people want fast chicken wings, like they want to be able to order them and a couple minutes later, like boom, like they're ready at the counter. The only way you're going to be able to pull that off is through a holding cabinet, and you're always going to be sacrificing quality. Now, that doesn't mean that the chicken wings can't be awesome. They're just not going to be perfect, right? So you're trading, and here's the thing. A lot of restaurants out there, their chicken wings suck, dude. I mean, if you can just serve a chicken wing that is not dry on the inside and that is sauced properly, you're going to be doing better than 99% of the wing joints out there. Because in my experience, when I go and order chicken wings at most restaurants, most of the time they're dry. Okay, so I'm not even concerned about crispy skin. It's like, hey, can you just serve me a chicken wing that isn't dry and mealy? And most of them can't. So if you want to have that crispy skin, you're going to have to start to look into possibly starch coatings, which are going to allow it's going to allow the surface of the wing to dry out better, just because you're tossing something in starch. So cornstarch, sometimes we like a mixture of like cornstarch, tapioca starch, and rice flour. So you can play around with different mixtures for that crispy coating on your chicken wing. But if you're looking to do something that's, you know, real quick service, you're going to have to make some concessions somewhere down along the lines. You know, and people don't go to a fast food joint expecting to have the best chicken wing ever or the best hamburger ever, right? They're going because the food is delicious for the price and it's convenient. So as long as you're hitting those markers, right, the food tastes good for the price and it's convenient and fast, then you're going to have a success on your hands. Will you have the perfect chicken wing? Probably not, but you'll have a damn good chicken wing that people are more than willing to line up for and pay you good money for. Mucho Bocho says, JW, your insights or your instincts are correct. Crispy skin from hot oil only has minutes before the skin is soft and at the worst flabby. Unless you coat the skin in a starch before frying, you'll lose that fresh, crisp, rendered skin quickly. No holding cabinet will change that. And he's pretty right with that. So there's not a whole lot you can do about it. If you want to pre-fry your wings, you're probably going to want to go with a starch coating. And Jay, in a follow-up, you ask, you know, why does the starch allow the skin to remain crisp during holding? It's just because it's easier to drive moisture out of the starch. You have a barrier there, right? So versus chicken skin is going to be rehydrated by its close contact with the meat faster than a starch coating will be. And there's nothing wrong with the starch coating on your chicken wings. I mean, you know, I was calling people cheaters beforehand because we're just trying to crack the code on the classic buffalo style wings where you have the naked wing fry approach. But there's plenty of starch coated chicken wings out there that are awesome. My velveted chicken wings being an example of that. Jay Weinstein says, Jacob referred to the dry heat method regarding the saucing in a sauce's audio. I just felt that sounded so cool. If such a method would work for crisping. When I say crisping, I mean salvaging or resurrecting crisp skin, provided the holding period has taken away from the crisp. So yeah, you can salvage crisp skin by frying it again, but then you risk possibly overcooking the wing. So the temperature at which you're holding the wing needs to hold the wing so that it is safely held at that temperature, meaning that's pasteurized. So you're not leaving the ability for bacteria to grow while you are holding that wing. And then it still needs to be at a low enough temperature to when you pull the wing out of the holder, you then drop it in the fryer basket and deep fry it, leading to a nice crispy skin. So yeah, you know, outside of what I've said, you're dealing with a different animal on your end. So if you want to do like a fast-paced, fast food style chicken wing joint, there's just going to have to be some R&D done on your end and some concessions that you're going to have to live with to pull that off. Let's see. Jay Weinstein and Mucha are talking about pressure fryers as they regard to chicken wings. So that's interesting, but we're going to skip over that since there's not really any questions laced in there. Selena, hello. She says, I just let chicken wings air dry for 24 hours, and it was interesting to see the changes. The skin eventually took on a scaly appearance. The skin on the wings must be full of water because it went as far as changing the skin surface. If you're double frying, do people air dry before the first fry or before the second fry? I think Chef Jacob said before that air drying, air drying before the first fry was a redundant exercise. I'm not quoting you here, Jacob. I was just under the assumption, based upon past audio tapes. Double fry, air dry before or after first fry. So in our experiments, to keep everything consistent, because it tends to be the normal approach, we were par cooking first and then air drying for 24 hours before the secondary cooking. So we were never air drying before the initial fry. And it just wasn't part of our testing. There's, I mean, we ran about 40 to 50 different tests. I'd have to look at my testing notes. And when you do each test, you have to control for a single variable. So allowing the wings to dry before our first fry just would have been another variable that we would have had to have test on all of our approaches, which is, you know, would have meant a lot more testing. So we have not tested the dry before the first cook. I also know that people air dry in the refrigerators because the air in a refrigerator is very dry air, if that makes sense. If that's the case, why not air dry in a freezer? Not long enough for wings to freeze, but say, so you can, but it takes time for the moisture to migrate away from the skin. And what's going to happen is through the crystallization of the water on the surface of the wings when you freeze, it will dry out the wings to a certain extent. But it's not going to be long enough for the air to wick away all of the surface moisture. So, and again, you're still not solving the collagen problem that we talked about earlier on in this episode. So really, you need to break down the collagen in the wings because the collagen is what binds to the water and what binds to the fat. And without breaking down that collagen first, you're never going to fully be able to wick the moisture away from the skin and get fully crisp skin, which is a, even though we haven't tested it, which is a, it would make a strong argument for why you it's not necessary to dry your wings before your first cook in your two-step cooking process, because you still haven't broken down the collagen yet, so you're not going to fully wick away the moisture of the wings. Now, you will still wick away some moisture in that skin, so it's going to be better than nothing, which is why when we're whole roasting a chicken, you know, we will first... It's appropriate to place the chicken in the fridge and air dry it overnight, and that will lead to crispier skin. But it's not going to be nearly as crispy as if you've first blanched the skin and then allowed it to rest in your refrigerator overnight. So that is my argument. So again, you need to break down that collagen and then let it air dry in your refrigerator overnight. After breaking down the collagen and letting it air dry in your refrigerator, can you freeze? Yes. Will that make a major difference in the crispiness of the skin? In our experience, no. But that's something that I would test more thoroughly on your end and make up your own mind about. So really what you're looking at is you want to have a good initial primary cook and then a secondary cook with a air dry resting step for at least 24 hours in between. Okay, so now in this thread, Selena and Mucho are discussing air dry in the refrigerator before first fry. So I'll let you guys go ahead and read through that on your own, and you can find a link to this question, or excuse me, a link to this forum topic in the episode 4 show notes. So again, you go to stellacast4, and it will drop you right into the show notes, which will have a link to the primary forum topic we are discussing, which is crispy skin. Now, Helen Bradley jumps in, and Helen says, at Mucho, I got a sous vide supreme weeks ago, but no good results. What time and temperature do you do your sous vide wings at? Problem I keep having is that I never know if it's tough or chewy on the second fry. I have a countertop fryer. It's commercial, but I use it at home. It's Swiss, super efficient, keeps temperatures very well, was expensive too. Is there any way that a cook can combat the risk of chewy? If the sous vide stage is done correctly, is it impossible to turn out chewy? Or does a second fry also play a role? So yes, I keep getting tough, dry, or chewy. Where am I going wrong? Because everyone here seems to be getting good results. The window between tough and chewy can't be that close, or else others wouldn't be getting such results. Oh, and Jacob, too, that goes without saying. Mwahaha. Okay, so one issue that I have with the... So you say the Supreme, right? So you're talking about, I assume that you're talking about the sous vide Supreme. So the issue that I have with the sous vide Supreme is that it is a water oven. It is not an immersion circulator. And that is why I actually recommend the Anova, because the Anova is an actual circulator. And I know people who use it and they've had good results with it. In our kitchen, we use the PolyScience circulators because they're more robust. They're a commercial grade. So, you know, an Anova can't circulate quite as much water as a PolyScience. And they're not built for to be used day in, day out, year after year. I mean, we have our circulators going almost every single day that we're in the kitchen. And they last us for years before we break them and burn them out. So that's why we use the PolyScience now. So when you're doing something like a water oven, because the water isn't circulated, you're dropping the wings into a warm bath, and that creates cold zones and hot zones. So a water oven is decent if you're doing like, you know, one or two steaks. But when you're dropping a bag full of wings into a water oven, you're going to have cold zones and hot zones, which is going to lead to uneven cooking. So that's something that you're going to have to combat. You know, I don't really like to go on here and bash other people's products, but you know, for me, the fact that the Anova, which is a true circulator, has come down in price so much. I mean, you can get them they're sub $200 now. I think they're having like a Father's Day sale that made them like around $100. And it actually circulates the water. So that circulating bath is what evens out the temperature and leads to more even cooking in the water bath. I think the sous vide Supremes, I've never been a big fan of them, and I think they're now obsolete because you can buy an Anova circulator for cheaper than a sous vide Supreme. So that might be causing you issues. For jumbo wings, we are doing 64 degrees Celsius for 4 hours is our par cook. Then we cut them directly out of the bag while they are still warm, and then we place them on a wire rack and allow them to cool overnight in the refrigerator and air dry for 24 hours before freezing. For smaller wings, we do the exact same temperature, 64 degrees Celsius, but for 2 hours. We have found that smaller wings will get slightly mealy if done for 4 hours, but we have, in our testing, we have served them to people who absolutely love them at 4 hours. And the what we call slightly mealy is a very fine point. Like, you have to like really be focusing on it to pick it up. I mean, I use the word slightly, like emphasize, like slightly, like ever so slightly. And that's just because we have them to compare to the jumbo wings that we cook for 4 hours. So small wings, you want to cook for 2 hours at 64 C. Larger wings, you want to cook at 4 hours at 64 C. And that's where we have been getting really good results. So the results that you're getting might be caused by the lack in consistency of heat, because you're using a water oven versus a circulating bath. Rob Sue, hey, what's up, Rob? He says, air drying is the most simple, most effective method for a crisp skin. I mess around with blanching, but I didn't think it helped. If you're a home cook, you have time for the 36-hour dry, but if you're running a place, that's not feasible. Would freezing take away the benefits of air drying? I cannot air dry for a long time if I knew freezing was an option, but I think it might just add moisture again. It wouldn't necessarily add moisture, Rob, but again, you're going to want to do an initial par cook and then let it air dry minimum overnight in your fridge. Outside of that, there's no other way around it. There's no shortcut to getting a really good chicken wing, unfortunately. Now, Rob Sue says, I was going to ask about triple cook regarding the myoglobin issue, which would be sous vide, then fry to remove redness, then finishing fry. Now, the reason why that wouldn't work, Rob, is the initial slow cook sous vide is going to be what's setting the red color in the myoglobin. So that red color is going to be set, so it doesn't matter how many times you fry or cook it afterwards. You're going to have that set color. The only way to get away from that set color is to cook it at a higher temperature and to cook it faster. So in my chicken wing testing, what I have found is the best way to get around that is for your initial cook to be steaming. So instead of doing sous vide, which to me, because the red color on the bones doesn't bother me. It may bother your customers. So when we're just trying to answer the question of, hey, what is the best chicken wing out there? Sous vide for us regarding our testing has been the best all around chicken wing. However, if the slightly red hue on the bone caused by the myoglobin, which is set by slow, low temperatures, if that's a deal breaker for you, then I would recommend you moving to steaming as your par cooking method, or the traditional par frying. But I actually believe that steaming is superior to the traditional par frying. Man Bear Pig says, I think the purpose of blanching is to kill bacteria. Yes, that can affect it, but it's not the only purpose. It depends on the nature of air drying. Yeah, no. So, yeah, we've talked about this a lot. So it sounds like a lot of people are just, at this point, because I haven't jumped into this thread yet, you have a lot of people kind of just throwing theories at the wall and talking about blanching. But really, to sum up our conversation, the purpose of blanching any sort of skin for crisping is it breaks down the collagen in the skin, which then allows the water and the fat contained in that skin to be driven out during a high temp cooking process. So until you break down the collagen in the skin, it doesn't really matter what else you do, you will not get crisp skin. Blanching is just one way to break down the collagen in the skin. When we are cooking chicken wings sous vide, because we are cooking them at 64 degrees Celsius for 4 hours, that is a high enough temperature long enough that allows the collagen in the skin to break down. So we don't need to blanch our wings. Now, when we are steaming the wings, we are essentially blanching them because we are applying moist high heat, just like you would with boiling. But because we have the film condensate, which comes from steaming, it's a much more forgiving process than boiling. When we are spatchcocking our chicken, we are pouring boiling water over the skin, which is hot enough to break down the collagen in the skin itself, but because we're just boiling the water over the skin and letting it run off, it's not affecting the interior meat. It's not cooking the meat. Versus, if you place the chicken in boiling water for a few minutes, you're going to start to overcook the surface of the meat just below the skin. So blanching will help to break down the collagen, which will then allow you to drive the fat and moisture out of the skin, leading you to crisper skin. Yeah. All right. Well, I told you guys that was going to be quite the episode. Not necessarily in a good way, but, sometimes we just have to sit there and really just drill down a subject. Talk about all different things that could affect how skin will dry, how skin will crisp, because once you nail down those topics, you're just going to have a better idea of what your approach should be and what you should be testing in your kitchen. So if you want to get included in one of these discussions, head on over to stellacorner.com/forum, and you can ask your questions there. You can always reach me on Twitter, at Chef Jacob, although I'd just rather you reach me on the forum, to be quite frank with you. And I will see all of you in the next episode of StellaCast.